From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
We are working very hard with other interested parties to see if we can reignite a diplomatic outcome. Why? Because everybody agrees there is no military solution. There is only a political solution. But to get the Assad regime to negotiate, we're going to have to make it clear to him that there is a determination by everybody to seek that political outcome and change his calculation about negotiating. That's underway right now. And I am convinced that with the efforts of our allies and others, there will be increased pressure on Assad.
And you'd be willing to negotiate with him?
Well, we have to negotiate in the end.
That was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry Sunday discussing what appeared to be a major turnaround in U.S. policy towards the Syrian government. On Monday, the New York Times report on Kerry's comments seemed to intimate that this was not a signal of a major policy change. According to Times reporter Michael R. Gordon, quote, Mr. Kerry's comments seemed to be more a reflection of his determination to try to bring about an end to the bloody war than a change of American strategy, closed quote. But on Sunday's Face the Nation, Peter Baker from the New York Times seemed to disagree, saying that Kerry's remarks implied that Assad could stay. When asked directly if this was a signal of changed policy from Washington, he said this.
Well, it is in a way, because the condition has always been through all of these negotiations that have taken place in the past on Syria with the Russians and others, was that Assad had to go and that he could not be a part of these conversations because, you know, except to negotiate his own withdrawal, in effect. So there is an implication in what Secretary Kerry just said that Assad might, in fact, have room to remain in power in some sort of future talks.
Baker's take on Kerry's comments seemed to be shared by the Washington Post's Dana Milbank, who pointed out that it was in contradiction to an authorization for military force bill that's working its way through Congress.
It's probably not terribly helpful what Secretary Kerry just said, because it may be true as a matter that you have to negotiate a political solution, but they're trying to get an authorization for the use of force through the Congress now. So you can imagine Senator Cotton hearing that and pulling out his quill pen and dashing off another letter now to Assad and saying, watch out, man.
Earlier this week, the U.S. once again called on the Syrian president to step down and accused his government of being brutal against the Syrian people. The U.S. has repeatedly demanded the resignation of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad in the 4 years since heavily armed groups backed by the U.S. and its allies began infiltrating the country from Turkey and Jordan to prosecute a war that has destroyed whole cities, killed nearly 80,000 people, and left millions displaced. President Obama and a host of other U.S. officials have placed the blame for the war on the Syrian government, saying for the past 4 years that Syria's president has lost his legitimacy. This was President Obama in July 2011.
You know, we've been very clear that what we've seen on the part of the Syrian regime has been an unacceptable degree of brutality directed at its people. But more broadly, I think that increasingly you're seeing President Assad lose legitimacy in the eyes of his people. And that's why we've been working at an international level to make sure that we keep the pressure up to see if we can bring some real change in Syria.
Bashar al-Assad was reelected as Syria's president last year in a landslide vote, carrying 88.7% of the votes cast, with 73.42% turnout. His 10,319,723 votes represented 57.3% of every living Syrian, man, woman, and child, both in Syria as well as in the Syrian diaspora. Police in Ferguson announced that a 20-year-old suspect was charged Sunday with the shooting of two police officers outside police headquarters Thursday. Police said the man, Jeffrey L. Williams, claimed to have been targeting someone other than the officers and shot them by accident from inside a car.
I'm going to let you know this morning that we have filed charges just a few minutes ago against Jeffrey Williams. Jeffrey Williams, a 20-year-old man. He is now charged with two counts of assault in the first degree for the two police officers who were shot a couple days ago in Ferguson in front of the police station. Also charged with firing a weapon from a vehicle. which is a Class B felony in the state of Missouri. The evidence developed at this point, and in part on his statement, that he may have had a dispute with some other individuals or felt some dispute. We're not sure we completely buy that part of it, but in any event, it's possible he was firing at some other people, and the officers, of course, were in the back.
We'll have more on that as it develops later in the week. Russian President Vladimir Putin has accused Washington of organizing what he described as an armed coup in Ukraine, saying Moscow saw through the U.S. ploy of hiding behind Europe in the bid to overthrow the former Ukrainian government. Putin said in an interview for a TV documentary, which aired Sunday in Russia, that the U.S. helped train the armed nationalist groups in West Ukraine, in Poland, and Lithuania that facilitated the armed coup in February of last year. In Brazil, competing pro- and anti-government rallies took place over the weekend. They began with a gathering of popular forces Friday, numbering in the hundreds of thousands, to defend the recently re-elected leftist president, Dilma Rousseff. But the right-wing's anti-Rousseff forces were also active this weekend, and they too got their forces out into the streets. They could be seen as part of more than 50 rallies held across Brazil Sunday. Those rallies were actually held to mark the 30th anniversary of the end of a brutal right-wing dictatorship in 1985, which was imposed by a U.S.-organized military coup on April 1, 1964, against the then-democratically elected socialist president, João Goulart. Signs calling for the impeachment of President Rousseff could be seen among those assembled at the rallies. The countries of Latin America and the Caribbean have been massing their support for Venezuela after Washington's latest hostile move, the presidential declaration that the elected government in Caracas constitutes a threat to U.S. national security. Foreign ministers from the 12-nation Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, slammed Washington's move during an emergency summit held Saturday in the Ecuadorian capital, which was called to discuss the recent events involving Venezuela. The ministers said the signing of the executive order by President Barack Obama on March 9th, which characterized Caracas as an extraordinary threat to U.S. national security, was actually a threat to Venezuela's sovereignty, which it termed, quote, an interventionist threat to the principle of non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries, closed quote. And there were massive rallies across the region supporting Venezuela and its elected socialist president, Nicolas Maduro. One massive rally was held in Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires, which included marchers from across the region. Press TV's Manuel Gaffani was there and filed this report from Buenos Aires.
Thousands of workers, scholars, and social activists from several Latin American countries gathered in Buenos Aires and rallied through the main streets of the city to protest against what they called the U.S. imperialist policy of aggression against Venezuela. The move follows a decision by President Barack Obama to declare the Caribbean nation as a security threat for Washington. The rally ended in front of the Venezuelan embassy, where the demonstrators voiced their support to the government of President Nicolas Maduro.
We have to stop the U.S. aggression to Latin America, and we have to stop it together. It's Washington who has posed a threat to our region for a long time.
Many of the scholars who joined the rally pointed out that the U.S. recently supported and fueled two coups in the region, which unseated the president of Honduras in 2009 and the president of Paraguay in 2012.
Grande la relación. Venezuela ha sido...
We all share a common struggle here, which is the fight against the U.S. imperialism, not only in Venezuela, but also in many other countries of the world.
The Nobel Peace Prize laureate Adolfo Pérez Esquivel also took part in the demonstration and called on the international community to support the struggle of Venezuela against U.S. imperialism.
We have to show the world that the only threat to the Latin American countries is actually the U.S. and its economic and military interests in the region.
Caracas has rallied the support of the vast majority of Latin American countries, who also slammed the U.S. administration for meddling in Venezuela's internal affairs. Furthermore, regional leaders and top diplomats urged the U.S. government to respect the national sovereignty of Venezuela and the legitimacy of President Nicolas Maduro as democratically elected head of state. Manuel Giovanni, Press TV, Buenos Aires.
Meanwhile, the Venezuelan military, in a joint operation with volunteer militias, began conducting their largest drills in years as the country took measures to safeguard its democracy and sovereignty. Visiting Russian military personnel were also scheduled to participate. Among some of the new hardware on display, a new anti-aircraft system and heavy rocket launchers. For more on this, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, from Nicaragua via Skype Saturday. So busy week again, as usual, maybe even busier this past week.
Yeah, and I was out of touch with things over the last few days, because as we were saying, I was away from the office where I work, and didn't even have contact with the internet. But when I got back, I was shocked actually to learn of this decree by President Obama.
Yeah.
And did he announce it? Was it last Monday that he announced it?
Monday, yeah, it came out Monday.
Yeah, that the United States regarded Venezuela as a threat to its national security and its foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Which is insane, and it's kind of really plumbing the depths of the most crude cynicism and the most opportunistic expediency, isn't it? 'Cause
I mean, honestly, I think Fidel Castro wrote something or was quoted in some article in Grandma or some media outlet, you know, saying what threat? They don't have strategic military capacity to strike the United States. They're not, you know, competing. You know, the share of military spending is, you know, down at the bottom, and the U.S. has about the third of the whole globe's, better than the third of the whole globe's. What threat?
Right. Yeah, I'm Daniel Ortega. And last night, Nicolas Maduro made a lightning visit to Nicaragua, apparently at very short notice. He was greeted by Daniel Ortega and what looked like almost all the population of Managua by the number of people in the streets.
Whoa, really?
And there was a big activity in the Plaza de la Revolución, the Revolution Square in Managua. Mm. And during the ceremony was actually to recognize Nicolas Maduro's contribution to building the vision and bringing to fruition the vision of Latin American unity and the unity of Latin America and the Caribbean, and moving towards the vision of Simón Bolívar and the other great precursors of Latin American independence. And here in Nicaragua, of course, the country of Augusto César Sandino, and who actually wrote one of his most well-known declarations is actually called the Supreme Dream of Bolívar, and very much in the spirit of moving towards a single Latin American and Caribbean nation.
Mm. You know, this past,
not just figuratively, but literally a political and economic union.
That's right, which is informed
of all of Latin America and the Caribbean.
Yep, which is being developed. I was Friday, this past Friday was the 54th anniversary of the speech John F. Kennedy gave as president. He was president for like 2 months at that point, barely. Where he declared a new relationship with Latin America and the Caribbean and established the Alliance for Progress. But the rhetorical statements he was making, you know, indicated a new day for a relationship between the United States and the other countries of the Americas. And it was striking to hear that speech Friday when only a few days earlier the same old bad stuff that they were doing up to and including that, in fact, a month after he gave the speech was the Bay of Pigs, it's still the same game that they're trying to play from Washington.
Yeah, and Daniel Ortega made a short speech prior to giving the word, and that's how they say it in Spanish, but dando la palabra to Nicolas Maduro.
Right.
And during that speech, I'm going back saying, why is Venezuela a threat? And Daniel Ortega said, well, it's very clear why Venezuela is a threat, because of its example.
Right. That's right.
And he said that in his speech. And later on, Nicolas Maduro went on to explain why the Venezuelan example is a threat to the United States, because he talked about the millions of people that have received literacy training in Latin America and the Caribbean as a result of Venezuela's policy in the region. And also he pointed out, just as one among many, many, many examples, the Mission Milagro, the ophthalmological program that Venezuela funds, has treated 4 million people in Latin America and the Caribbean who would otherwise not have received treatment for the problems affecting their vision.
Right.
You know, 4 million.
That's a lot. I know. That's a huge number.
Yeah, and so what is the threat to the United States? Well, it's the threat as the example of a socialist-inspired economic and political program.
Named after Bolivar, with the vision of a united Latin America.
Yeah, and that's in contrast to the utter failure of corporate capitalism in the region to do all the wonderful things that neoliberalism 30 years ago promised it would do. Mm. Deliver prosperity, deliver democracy.
Right.
And of course, it's done neither of those things. It's incapable of doing either of those things. And that's why Venezuela is a threat to the United States, because the United States political and economic system is, as we all know all too well, a system based on corporate capitalism and on oligarchic control by a ruthless, genocidal elite.
On June 14, 2012, Lorenzo Johnson, whose wrongful conviction was finally overturned by a federal court, turned himself in to go back to prison, again serving out a sentence of life without parole for a murder in 1995 that he insists he did not commit. After serving more than 15 years of his sentence, with a trail of paper and proceedings through both the state and federal court systems, Johnson's claim of innocence was accepted by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit, which decided that the state had failed to prove his guilt and ordered him released. After his release, his case went before the U.S. Supreme Court, which ordered him back to prison on May 29, 2012. In this fourth installment of the investigation into his case, we spoke with Lorenzo Johnson this past Sunday about some of the details of a subpoena he received to testify this coming March 27th in the case of his co-defendant.
I'm being subpoenaed because they feel, I guess, there's a conflict between what's going on with my appeal and his appeal. I don't look at it as a conflict because it's the same goal as, you know, we're both innocent.
So, and the attorney for your co-defendant is Corey Walker, is the co-defendant, is Rachel Walkenstein. She's also one of the attorneys that have represented Mumia Abu-Jamal over the years.
Yeah.
So what is the case that's being tried with Corey Walker that you're being asked to testify in? What is that case about?
Well, basically, you know, I guess it's a disqualification hearing that, you know, the Attorney General feels that, you know, Ms. Wilkinson violated, you know, whatever policies or, you know, formalities between lawyer-client privilege or whatever. And, you know, it's just an excuse it's just an excuse to delay time and take the spotlight off the issue at hand, and that's our innocence.
So what's the nature of the accusation? I mean, I assume it's a canon of ethics issue or something.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Pardon me?
I assume they're charging her with, like, some kind of conflict of interest, like ethics violation or something.
Yeah, something like that. I really don't know fully until I get there. I don't really know. But at the end of the day, for my part, I don't see it as a conflict.
Right.
You know, and I don't see it as a problem, but I believe that, you know, prior things being used to muddy the waters to take the attention off, you know, our innocence. you know. And right. I think prior things, I'm going back to the Mumia's case, and you know, things that happened previously that's peripheral to what's going on today.
Right, but that it kind of shines a light on the practices that they use.
Exactly. So it's basically, you know, I look at it as a tactic to muddy the waters, because, you know, just like we haven't a hearing from this, we should have a hearing on my innocence.
You know, yeah, perhaps more so. You know, what are the risks? The risks to, if they leave her in place with the alleged ethical violations, the risks are only speculative. You're in prison suffering the damage every day. You would think you would get more of a tip of the hat.
You would figure that, right? Right. And you would figure that the prosecution would tell evidence, you know, for almost 20 years now, that that's ethics violation, and that's going against policies and violation of due process, and, you know, and things of that nature. But that's not the case at this minute. Don't get me wrong, my appeal's still going on. This doesn't affect
right.
my appeal that I have in play. But right. it delays everything. And how dare you, you know, say that somebody's not, you know, that violated any codes or anything with anything. The prosecution is there from day one.
You know,
they're continuing to do it.
But there's some ghosts in this situation that you're in now. And, the state obviously has some interest in separating Corey from his lawyer, which they're pursuing with this action. Whatever it is, you can speculate, whatever, but that's clearly a goal that they have. And they're asking you to come in and testify with respect to that. Now, the way you ended up where you are in the first place is they wanted you to testify falsely against someone in connection with the murder, which you weren't even
exactly.
around for. You were in New York when it happened. And
exactly.
So, and what happened?
It's definitely the same thing, and I'm sitting in the same prison going on 20 years because I wouldn't cooperate with them.
See, now, we saw over in Ferguson this past week, we've been seeing cascading. You know, the Attorney General, for all the other things he failed to do, the Department of Justice issues a report that tells the truth about some of the things that happened in Ferguson. And so you see the police chief resign, you see the judges resign, and all of this. In Pennsylvania alone, there were hundreds of cases like yours, some of them well-known and widely publicized, and you also have that whole prison, you know, pay-for-prison scandal where judges were getting a commission for every kid that they sentenced to a prison that was privately owned. If that came out in an attorney general's report, what kind of reverberations would that have through the state government? I mean, Ferguson has almost no government. Everybody's quitting.
And you figure in Pennsylvania, not recently, like last year, a scandal broke with within the Attorney General's office that prosecuted my case, a pornographic scandal where some of them were sending and receiving pornographic emails and
right.
things like that on the government computers.
Right.
And at work they was doing this. And the first person who was resigned was Christopher Abruzzo. Now, Christopher Abruzzo was the trial prosecutor in my case. He is the attorney general that withheld evidence of my innocence and is just coming out 19 years because of him.
Mm.
And this is not being addressed at all, but yet still, we're headed to the courtroom while they're trying to disqualify a lawyer. Like, you know, this
right.
is not adding up here. You know, this is not what's going on.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting
like,
contrast.
You know, when people say, well, how can I put it? You know, there's no way in the world that, you know, this shouldn't be talked about. This shouldn't be addressed.
Right.
But they'll sweep it under the rug. And like I told you previously, they'll muddy the waters and get the attention off the topic at hand.
Mm.
And, you know, the whole thing, like I said previously also, is that, you know, they withheld evidence of my innocence for almost 20 years. And then when I speak about it and my attorneys file petitions on my behalf claiming wrongdoing, they blame me for defaming a career cop and a career prosecutor. But these are the people who knowingly and intentionally, maliciously prosecuted two innocent men.
Yep.
So,
yep. Yeah, I mean, the pornography thing is, it couldn't be better symbolism if you wrote it into a movie, you know.
Say that again?
His association with pornography couldn't better symbolize all of the actions, you know, or the types of actions that he has taken as a prosecutor. If you wrote it in as a part in a movie, you couldn't make clearer symbolism. It's actually quite funny that came out about him and none of the real misdeeds that he's done.
Exactly.
So,
you know, I got to go to court on the 27th, and, like, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, I guess they asked me questions, when did I meet Ms. Wilkenstein, or, you know, when have we talked about legal stuff? But at the end of the day, you know, she's an advocate against, you know, injustice. And I speak to everybody and anybody who will listen about my innocence and Corey's innocence. So, you know, just calling me is like, I don't understand what's the goal of calling me for, but at the end of the day, I'm getting subpoenaed and I'll be in court in Dauphin County in front of Todd Hoover, my trial judge, who's also, I'm waiting for a hearing date for my appeal. I'll be in his courtroom on the 27th of this month.
You know, I'm wondering, I think maybe our listeners might find it interesting, just, you know, your first-hand view of it. And how long have you been it's Matinoy, is that how you say it?
Say it again?
How long have you been, is it Mahoney, how do you say it, Matinoy?
Since 2008.
Okay, so that's 7 years. So how many people do you think you've gotten to know there?
A lot. I met a lot of people here, and I met one person who got exonerated last year that was a good friend of mine, Eugene Gilliard. And I met two that's on the brink right now.
Because I'm trying to... Have you gotten to know, like, tens of people, dozens, hundreds? That, you know, could you just give me an idea of scale?
I'm one of many. Like, you know, and I always stress this because I'm not the only one. I'm just one that have a mouthpiece and an audience that will listen to me because I became a writer because of this situation.
Right.
It's people that, you know, that's innocent, that, you know, got good chances to go home with representation. It's people that's here that's innocent, that's in the courts, that, you know, they're waiting for decision. And there's some people that's innocent here that have been framed up so bad that, you know, they'll never see society again unless it's on a visit.
Is it unusual to like, if you met five people, how many of them would you say were probably actually innocent?
I wouldn't say out of five. I say out of every 20 you see, you might run into one or two.
One or two that are clearly innocent.
It's certain things that, you know, innocent prisoners could say to each other and the other one to know he's innocent or she's innocent. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can I say? Like, we could talk and the other one could finish the sentence.
Right.
That type of thing.
Right,
you know?
Similar experience.
Exactly. It's just that, you know, some case might be dealing with DNA, some case might be dealing, you know, with circumstantial evidence, some case might look open and shut, but it's all lies, you know, and it just takes, you know, certain cases to break. Like in my case right here, like it's a case that was overturned last year, and the guy's name was Kareem Illy, and he pled guilty to a lesser charge because his family forced him to do it, but he was innocent. And his co-defendants went to court last year also, but they went to court for a different issue. And the same detective, Kevin Duffin, in my case, was taking this witness in that case, which was the only witness, just like this case, out to McDonald's every week for coaching.
You have 1 minute left.
That this witness said on the stand.
So that's
And,
just,
you know, this witness said after all these years that everything was a lie. Right. The same thing with my situation, but it gets swept under the rug. You never hear about it.
I mean, you can see that that's the method of practice. They pick one witness, they cultivate a relationship with them, and they apply pressure at the same time, and they have the example of people like you that wouldn't play ball being behind bars.
Exactly.
Wow. Okay, we'll talk about this some more next week. So your court appearance is on the 27th. So that's
27th.
That's a week from this coming Friday. Okay, we'll talk about that too. Thank you, Lorenzo. We'll speak with you again next week.
Okay.
We will continue to cover the case of Lorenzo Johnson as it develops. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.